For our last but certainly not least talk of the day, Scott Alexander from the University of Minnesota has agreed to talk to us about something completely different. Well, largely different. He's going to talk about hydrogeology of the Sudan mine in Minnesota, applications to terrestrial and extraterrestrial research. Scott, take it away.
All right. We'll see if we can keep everyone awake here through the end of the day. We're glad everyone's hung out here and hopefully learned quite a bit from the speakers today. We are going to take it a very different tack here. It is very hydrogeology related, and it's definitely a mining operation, but from there it gets a little different. As with most projects, there's a whole cast of characters. This is a partial list. There's certainly a lot more. Not too bad for a project that hasn't had any dedicated funding yet. There's a lot of interest, and we're hoping to build on that and actually generate some real science out of this. We got started up here a few years ago when the physicists who have a neutrino detector in the bottom of the Sudan mine, and if you've ever taken the underground tour of the mine, they not only show you some of the historic mine workings, they also show you this high-energy physics experiment. And what they're doing is shooting neutrinos from Chicago basically through the Earth into the Sudan mine. And this is something only physicists could dream up. But the physicists wanted to do more. And it turns out that 2,400 feet underground, they're still getting a little bit of cosmic ray background radiation. And so they were thinking about adding a basement. They wanted to get down to about 8,000 feet. And so the real question came down to what other kinds of science could we do? If we were to build this physics experiment, we can do some real science with that. But for the expense of this physics experiment, what other kinds of science could we add into this that would generate more benefit for all the research dollars? As it turns out, this project actually went to two other sites, one in the Black Hills and one in Colorado. So the Sudan folks aren't going to get their basement. But in the process, we were strongly encouraged to submit our own projects and see what we could do for science up here, just in terms of hydrology, geology, and so on. So we'll take a little detour here. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this cartoon series. It's on the web. If you've seen this before, you're almost certainly a nerd, but it's still pretty funny. So we're going to use this cartoon as a little bit of an illustration here. If you opened up a biology textbook, even from the last 15 or 20 years, it would have told you that almost all the life on this planet gets its energy from sunlight. And so the biosphere on Earth extends from the tops of the trees down to the bottom of the photic zone in lakes, rivers, and oceans. And so the assumption would be that the bulk of the biomass would be in this basically photic zone that's providing all the energy for the plants, animals, and various critters living on the planet. One of the big discoveries we've made is that there's actually a lot more going on, particularly in the ocean depths. And we're going to look a little bit here at the very deep oceans. You get these things called black smokers down here. And you develop these biological systems that are completely independent of sunlight. And here's an example. This is from off Vancouver Island up in Canada. They're 2,000 meters below the sea level here. Temperatures here I had coming out some of these vents, and you can see some of the vents up in here. There's another smoker vent here. So up here and here. The vent temperatures are 300 to 400 Celsius. That's three or four times the boiling temperature of 100 C. What makes that possible is the water isn't boiling. So it turns out one of the fundamental constraints on life isn't necessarily 100 C. There's nothing magic about that. The problem is at room temperatures and pressures, 100 C, things start boiling, and if you're a microbe with a cell wall, boiling is bad news. In this deep environment, the pressures are high enough, the boiling temperatures are still above these temperatures. So in fact, we can have life down here, and the high temperatures, and particularly the metals that are mobilized in these fluids, provide energy for a lot of microbiology, different bacteria and archaea that form the base of a food system that goes all the way up into little tube worms, sea fans here, and even little crabs and pretty good-sized critters, all living without the benefit of sunlight. In Minnesota, this isn't really our problem. We aren't that deep, and we aren't that hot. So we'll reel it back here a little bit. This map, mainly we're just trying to show the location here of the Sudan mine. It's up here in Tower, Minnesota. If you've gone canoeing out of the boundary waters through Ely, you've probably driven right by there. And again, if you are heading up to Ely in the summer, it's well worth your while to take a tour down the Sudan mine. It's a very interesting state park, and for a nominal fee, they'll give you a ride down a shaft to 2,400 feet underground and give you a fairly nice tour. So what is our hydrologic environment like up here? We don't have any black smokers. We don't have 2,000 meters of seawater. We do have lots of water. Lake Vermilion is a very good-sized lake, a little bit less than 2,000 meters deep. This area is characterized by a fairly shallow water table, thin surficial sediments, a lot of variety of glacial sediments, and then a lot of hard, fractured, igneous, and metamorphic rocks, and then, of course, quite a variety of banded iron formation that forms the basis for the mine itself. Starting out here, there's kind of three classic zones of water that have been hypothesized up here. There's definitely the modern surface waters that are precipitation derived. So those are our recent waters. They look a lot like normal precipitation water in Minnesota now. There's always been a hypothesis that the glaciers, with that huge pressure head, all that weight of ice, should have pushed some water into the subsurface. So somewhere down there, we think there should be some glacial meltwater. And then if you go deep enough into continental rocks, almost anywhere in the world, you run into these calcium chloride brines. And there's a lot of conjectures about how those form, what kinds of processes go into that. But this is the basic framework that's been developed that we should have three main types of groundwater up here. We'll zoom in a little bit here on the mine itself. Again, I didn't even include the legend with the various rock types here. But as Jim mentioned this morning, the rocks in this area have quite a variety of different compositions. And in our case, we have both fairly felsic rocks that are representative of continental type rock chemistries. And we also have a lot of very mafic, more basaltic type rocks, which are much more representative of oceanic crust. So within one fairly small area here, we have rock types that represent, or could be used as analogs for most of the rocks on the surface of the planet Earth. So that gives us a lot of environments for potential microbiology to hang out here. The mine itself, the 27th level, is composed of two drifts here that are about a half mile long in each direction. And then hanging off the end here is the physics facility, the Minos lab, where they have their neutrino detector. And you can see the one here is kind of lined up with Chicago way down off the map here. In cross-section, you can see what they were doing. They were had their haulage shaft in the footwall, and then they would dig horizontally and then stope upwards into the mineable ore. The miners, it turns out, they like to dig. It's much easier to let the rock fall down and then shovel it out than to try to blast a hole down into it. The mine itself has a number of levels. They run in about 100-foot intervals. And then where they ceased mining operations was at the 27th level. And the 27th level winds up being about 2,400 feet below the surface. Dean Peterson, along with some of his colleagues, like Jim Miller, have been working very hard at mapping some of the geology here, and have actually dug into the old mine files and have started developing some three-dimensional GOCAD models of the mine. So we have a tremendous wealth of geologic information, along with some very good people to help us interpret that. So I think we'll just start out here. We'll show you a couple points, starting out here on the 10th level, and then down on the 23rd, and then we'll spend most of our time down at the bottom. So 10th level, down 23rd, and then the very bottom. We've heard a little bit about some of the copper and nickel deposits up here. This deposit probably isn't economic, but it certainly has created some issues for the mine as far as some of the dewatering that they do. They do have an NPDES permit and are trying to treat this water to remove the copper and nickel and some of the other trace metals before it's discharged to the surface. But it does create some very pretty colors. You get some nice malachites and azurites. And it turns out there's more than a little microbiology hanging out in some of these pools as well, working off some of the redox gradients in here. As we go further down, we get some examples here. This is a stalagmite that's forming from water dripping from the ceiling. What's a little hard to see is that there's actually some fabric that this is sitting on. This is an old miner's jacket that was left there probably in the 60s, and this thing has grown since then. This isn't a nice calcium carbonate stalagmite. This one, it turns out, is goethite and ferrihydrite. So some assorted iron minerals growing here. If you look up in the ceiling, you get some nice little soda straws. If you're in a cave in southeastern Minnesota, the soda straws are usually a nice white color. These are just pitch black soda straws. Again, some variety of iron oxide minerals forming these. And as we cut some of those open, you get some layers that are iron oxides. But then inside them, in the cores of these, we get some chemical signatures that are much more indicative of some microbial activity. And so there may be some inorganic mineral formation on the outside of these, but the inside, we do definitely have some microbiology growing and utilizing some of these iron minerals. And here we are down at the bottom, 2,341 feet below the surface. This is also almost 690 feet below sea level already. So when you think about the transport of water, the hydraulic flow, what is the gradient driving this water? We're already well below sea level, so we have some very small effects of hydraulic gradients that are produced way up high, that are transmitted way down deep through these rocks. And the bottom line is this water probably isn't moving very fast. There just isn't much gradient to push it anywhere. The waters that we're sampling in some of these boreholes can be twice as salty as seawater. Where it comes out, and let's bump ahead here. This is actually an old diamond drill hole. What you're looking at is a wooden plug that was pounded into the borehole when they were done drilling it, just so I guess they didn't kick gravel down it or whatever. But over time, it's that borehole is filled with water, and it's slowly seeping water out now. And this water, as I mentioned, is about twice as salty as seawater. It's well on its way to being a calcium chloride brine. And you can see from the colors, the very dark colors, this is very reduced water coming out. So the dark colors in here around the borehole. And then there's also various gases bubbling out of there. And I think I even got a composition here. This is about 90% methane. You can actually light some of these on fire. Some of the tour guides think this is great fun. There's also some other gases in there, which again are fairly indicative that there's some microbial activity going on here. So this water, this isn't water that's seeping in to the 27th level. This is actually water that's seeping into this diamond drill hole and flowing into the mine. And so this drill hole, it turns out, this particular one, is about 500 feet long. It starts out at a 50-degree slope, and then they flattened it out basically to get core from what would have probably been the 29th level. So if they had continued mining, they were already mapping out the ore body down at the next deepest level. And so it turns out this particular core hole that makes some of the saltiest water that we found is also one of the deepest core holes in the mine here. And if we take some of those sediments from the pool there and do some electron microscopy, we find a variety of things. Most notably, we get a lot of ferrihydrite, and these little balls and strings are very indicative of biological processes. We also get some minerals in here, notably jarosite, which if you've been following any of the work on Mars, one of the minerals that they're finding to be of great interest on Mars is actually jarosite, which is a sulfate mineral. In this case, it's not being precipitated from a sulfate-rich brine. It's actually a calcium-magnesium chloride brine with about 50 parts per million sulfate. So it's not exactly a high sulfate environment, yet somehow with the biological processes, we're actually getting jarosite out of this whole chemical processing. We'll show you a little stable isotope data. We've managed to con a few people into doing some analyses for us, even though we don't have any dedicated funding yet. But we're finding some interesting results. We're seeing some of the things we might expect. We're seeing a few samples that fall very near the meteoric waterline, which would be indicative of the modern precipitation. The glacial meltwater so far is really a no-show. The glacial meltwater should be isotopically very, very light. And at present, we just aren't seeing that. We are seeing some indication that we might be getting a little bit of methane fractionation. Again, at these very deep boreholes that are actually producing some methane. So we've got some encouraging results. even if the glacial meltwater hasn't shown up yet. We're also seeing some evaporative fractionation. This is actually Lake Vermilion, and then one of the rivers feeding in. Surface waters in Minnesota very often show this strong fractionation due to evaporation from the lake surface. So again, we're seeing things that are indicative of modern surface waters. We really aren't seeing the glacial meltwater, and at this point, we really don't know how old some of these waters are down here at the 27th level. So we have a lot of work ahead of us in interpreting these. This is another drill hole. In this case, rather than putting the drill hole in it at an angle downwards into the next level of the mine, this one went in horizontally. So they were trying to map out where they were going to mine on this level. And then when they were done, they abandoned the hole. And so what you're seeing is the hole is right about here, and actually the anchor they used for the drill is right above it. So the hole is right there, and then the drill anchor is right above it. And what's been happening now since they drilled this in the early 60s is water's been slowly seeping out. And where it hits the oxygen-rich atmosphere, you get all sorts of various iron minerals precipitating. And again, we're going from very reduced conditions in the borehole itself to very oxidized conditions on the outside. So a very, very strong geochemical gradient here. So where are some other areas that we see some interesting geochemical gradients? One area that I'm sure more than a few of you have visited is out in Yellowstone National Park. Mammoth Hot Springs, we have a variety of pools here. And one of the things to note here is the colored areas, the colored pools are actually the areas with active flow. Where the water stops flowing or is bypassed to some other channel, the carbonate minerals precipitating there very quickly bleach out to a white color. Sometimes some of these rimstone dams can get very large. This is an example from Afghanistan. And what we're looking at here is a lake held up by a dam of calcium carbonate. This material forms a self-leveling dam around the perimeter. So there's our little perimeter. And we can look at this from the side. This is a pretty good-sized structure. You can see the people standing at the bottom here. Pretty impressive lake for a naturally formed dam. So what does this have to do with Sudan here? At the bottom of this picture, we actually have some examples of some rimstone dams. These aren't calcium carbonate. These are actually mostly ferrihydrite. But we're forming a variety of little rimstone dams here that are, again, formed by both inorganic oxidation processes, but also a lot of mediation by biological microbiology processes as well. So where are we going with all this? We're very interested in some of these environments in terms of what they can tell us about other planets. In particular, one planet we're very interested in is Mars. There's a growing body of evidence that there has been active flow of water on Mars. All sorts of hydrologic surface features that show up on the Martian satellite pictures. We know that a lot of these are fairly young because they haven't been cratered out. They have very low crater densities, so they can't be real old, but we don't know exactly how old. Now that we've had some satellites in orbit around Mars, in some cases for more than 10 years, we're starting to actually see some changes on the surface. There's still a lot of debate as to whether these are due to flowing water or some kind of dry process, but we are seeing active surface activity. on the surface of Mars. And it may be water, but there's a lot of conjecture about that. And one of the problems is, and here's that phase diagram you're all worried about. The triple point of water, where we go from liquid and gas to solid, for Martian surface conditions, things should be pretty frozen. Even on the equator of Mars at the peak of summer, we aren't quite making it to liquid water temperatures. And so I think this is where a lot of the uncertainty about how do these features form on Mars, how do they occur? We just can't imagine how you can get liquid water for short-term events. Maybe you have a little magmatic body or a radioactive hotspot, something that can produce some heat, at least for some period of time, but how do you sustain that for a long period of time? And the reason we're interested in a long period is if you want the conditions for life to occur, you need to sustain that water for a significant length of time in order for life to evolve and form in the first place. Just some more pictures here. This is a picture that's very well known. This has been on the cover of Science magazine, showing some of the gullies in a crater wall. So how do we get liquid water? This is a traditional Piper diagram, and what we've done is laid it back at a little bit of an angle, and the height of the bars are the salinities. It's telling you what the dissolved solids in that sample are. So for a lot of surface waters, a lot of fresh waters, you have very low TDS. But as you come to some of these brines, and here's seawater for reference, the blue square. And then in red, we have the Sudan mine. And then in two different types of systems in continental rocks, we see some nice calcium chloride brines, and then we can also generate some similar brines even in basaltic terrains. So what does all that salt do for us? What it does is the eutectic melting point for a calcium chloride brine is actually quite a bit colder. This is actually about minus 52 Celsius. So we can get to liquid temperatures well within the Martian conditions, and we don't have to come up with any fancy hypotheses about how we got there. These calcium chloride brines are actually very interesting fluids. They're probably stable on geologic timescales. If you try to evaporate it down, it'll actually start sucking water out of some of the hydrated minerals, or if you dilute it, it's actually going to try to dissolve more calcium and chloride from wherever it can find it. So you have a fluid that may actually be stable over very long time periods. You see some hints of this places like Antarctica. This is in the dry valleys in Antarctica. Here we have a glacier, and then the pool is actually in a little tarn down here. But this is a liquid pool that can stay liquid down to very cold temperatures. So that picture I showed you of the Martian environment, we have the same crater wall here with the gullies running down. And if you actually look a little further down on the image, we have this very interesting structure down here that looks a lot like a rimstone dam. And the thing we know about rimstone dams is that's not a landslide. That had to have liquid behind it to create that self-leveling mechanism. So it took a fair amount of water to make the rimstone dam. So what can we learn about life on Earth and how it might apply to other places? We know that life is very tough. It's tenacious. It hangs on even when conditions are not favorable. It's metabolically very diverse. And when conditions get tough, it can actually move into the rocks itself. The microbial world is also incredibly diverse. The number of microbes on this planet completely dwarfs the number of stars in the universe. This is just a mind-boggling concept, how completely infested this planet is with life and how diverse it is. We've looked at this in a couple ways. We can try to culture individual bacteria and see what they're living off of, and we can also do environmental DNA sequencing to look at the whole range of what kinds of metabolic processes it's using. So again, there's an incredible diversity of life. Most of these bacteria have never been cultivated. We haven't figured out how to do it in the lab. But to really understand them, we need to do a little more work on this. And one of the places we can really get good access to this environment is in the Sudan mine. It's a state park. It's maintained. It's not going to flood out on us. It's not an active mine, so we don't have to worry about mine trucks running us over. We have to watch out for the occasional tourist, but that's not too hard. So we've actually isolated some of the bacteria here, and it turns out these bacteria, and I think even, we have a little phylogenetic tree we've been working on, and one of the interesting things is the Sudan samples are all these guys that go back very early in the phylogenetic tree. Modern oceanic marine bacteria are out here. So it looks like most of the modern oceanic bacteria were actually derived from the bacteria we're finding in the Sudan mine. We've also done some of the environmental DNA sequencing. We looked at samples from the very reduced environments and the very oxidized samples. Not surprisingly, we saw very different metabolic processes or pathways from those two environments. So we're seeing a variety of microbes using basically many of the available microbial pathways. Again, these are all sunlight independent. They're living off these redox reactions in the rock itself. And both reduced and oxygenated. This is a place where we might actually learn something about how the oxygen-rich atmosphere of the Earth evolved in the first place. This is some of the first places where we took oxygen from the mineral phase and released it as a gas. So there's a tremendous amount of potential for research here. So why Sudan? We have lots of nice redox gradients. It's a system that's been there a very long time. We're talking billion or several billion year old rocks. These microbes have been happily living there for a very long time. It's independent of the surface processes. They're representative of some of the earliest forms of life. And we think very seriously that on Mars we'd expect to see some of these same types of processes active in life there. So we'll leave you here. Instead of taking questions, we'll actually leave you with a question. Where is the real diversity of life on this planet? Is it up in the traditional biosphere running off sunlight? Is it in the deep oceans? Or is it actually in the rock itself? Is that where the real diversity of life is on this planet? And that's the question we're really trying to get to.